So as I mentioned, I'll be giving Bhagavatam class each day this week. As we try to look a little closer at some of the intricacies of coming to devotional service, executing devotional service, look at some of the esoteric ways of how Bhakti Devi relates to the living entity. And so yesterday we mentioned some things about what is responsible for bhakti, how it surfaces. We were looking a little bit at Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core's life, and we will discuss a little more about his life in some of the other classes. We examined some, also reflected on some things about Radha Damodar, as we want to intensify our meditations, reflections, and commitments, sharpen our consciousness during this wonderful time, and also honor our own wonderful chance to think and serve their lordships. So today I wanted to look at a very short chapter, the first shower of nectar, it's called Madhuya Kandambini. We'll look at the second shower, I'm sorry. Yesterday we did most of the first, so we'll go to the second. Here we look at, we know that importance of Shraddha, the faith, when it comes to engaging in devotional service. Sometimes people feel a little shy or intimidated about the whole concern about faith. Sometimes people even declare that the whole process of religiosity is just a matter of blind faith, people accepting things because somebody said this, somebody wrote this. That religion itself is just a hype. That it's all pie in the sky because nobody knows anything until they lose the body. Or it's a way how to appease people while they have these artificial aspirations about something higher. But we know that's not really religion. Maybe for some people that's what religion has become to be, just a matter of axioms and dogmas and rituals and lots of hypocrisy. But that's not really religion, that's some other stuff. But we see that real religion is, it's like it is real knowledge. Real knowledge is understanding the necessity of engaging in devotional service. And the more that one has knowledge, Buddha, Bhava, Samanvitaha, when one dedicates themselves to Krishna, to the degree that there is genuine knowledge, understanding, then there is corresponding attachment and absorption. So, we don't feel shy about faith. It's a matter of how the faith is reposed. We also know that faith is there in everything, even in secular things, some faith is necessary. We do see that by the quality of faith, one will make certain types of alignment. Why someone is experiencing distress, but their faith causes them or brings them to Krishna. Somebody else is experiencing some distress, but their faith causes them to turn to sense gratification vigorously. Or somebody who had some basic faith and they were engaged in Krishna consciousness, and some challenge, obstacle, some problem comes in their life, and then they start turning against Krishna. Or they lose enthusiasm to dissipate in practically all the activities of devotional service. And at the same time, why is it another person's faith? They're in devotional service. Some things are happening in their life. And then what they do is they even more deeply are involved in the devotional process. Each case, it has something to do with the quality of faith that's related to, of course, quality of consciousness. See, some people, some setbacks, some problems in their life, they become more and more serious, like anything, more realized. And other people, something happens in their lives, and they start questioning, doubting, almost everything. So, Bhakti Devi is very much responding, noticing the quality of faith, relationship to consciousness. So, Vishwanath Chakrabarti explains that now we shall discuss bhakti and the symptoms of bhakti. There are two kinds of bhakti. Shraddha, he explains devotional service performed with faith. And then there's the Mishra, or what we normally refer to as mixed devotional service. So now, mixed devotional service, it also manifests in different ways. That is devotional service, but now there's some stuff in there that doesn't belong. You're trying to cook something, and you're putting the wrong spices, or some lie, something that's come in, just destroying your preparation. Some roach, some rat, hopefully you don't have those experiences. But something is there that now is getting spoiled. You put salt instead of the sugar. So, what are these things that a devotion is forming? It brings some incoherence in different ways. Great disturbance. So, first he tells about the Mishra. You think of Mishra like mixing something that doesn't belong. So, of course, we hear the Kama Mishra Bhakti, the Jnana Mishra Bhakti, Yoga Mishra Bhakti. So, Kama Mishra Bhakti, Bhakti is there, but it's mixed with this fruitive moods and desires orientation. And then the Jnana Mishra Bhakti, Bhakti is there, but so much other stuff, mental stuff, has entered. And so this, all this mental stuff is to the point that rather than trying to understand, to experience, to know, to serve, and to understand how best to serve, that one is more into just trying to enjoy, or trying to be a pundit without following. Still dealing with the activities of bhakti, the discussions of bhakti, but Bhakti Devi does not come forth so strongly because it's his mix. And then Yoga Mishra Bhakti. Bhakti, the goal is there, but there's so much real interest mostly in siddhic powers and mysticism and subtler things, yoga, etc. So linking is there, but still the linking is contaminated. He says, Bhakti Devi is the inspiration for all activities favorable to the process of surrender. Like a touchstone, Bhakti Devi gradually converts the iron of material sense perception to the goal of spiritual understanding merely by the powers of her association. It is like a touchstone is turning metal into gold. So where there's the bhakti with the jnana, with the yoga, with these things, there's some success. But as the bhakti is touching more and more, and all of these things, they turn into pseudo-bhakti. So now, as we move from that, we look at the two categories of bhakti in terms of how the creep of devotion brings two fresh leaves, he describes. And he looks at the bhakti as these two leaves of sadhana bhakti, which is, of course, regulated devotional service. He describes the first leaf He takes the category of sadhana bhakti, and then two leaves under that category. So he calls klesha the first leaf, called klesha sangni, the destroyer of distress. So the first klesha, the first leaf is the bhakti. It eradicates distressfulness. One is feeling remorseful, one is feeling distress, one is in all kind of anxiety. So when Bhakti Devi comes through, then it alleviates distress. But that's only one of the leaves. It's not necessarily the main leaf. But the other leaf is called Subhada, which means the bestower of good fortune. So the elimination of the distress, and then the benedicting of good fortune. These two leaves may also be described as Vairi Bhakti, regulated devotional service, and Raga Bhakti. Raga, spontaneous. Now the difference of modes depends entirely on the practitioner's level of realization. The soft inner core of these two leaves represents the devotee's mood of constant hankering for a loving relationship with the Lord. Constant hankering. When he attains his loving relationship, the devotee feels that he belongs to the Lord and to the Lord's associates. This elevated stage is known as Raga Bhakti, or what we refer to as spontaneous love, where the devotee has this intense longing, this intense hankering, and the devotee is really, in the core of his heart or her heart, really wanting to regain their original consciousness. And so, Bhakti Devi is taking notice of such and responding according to the degree of how the faith is there, the determination, etc. But we said, not only based on that, but along with the ritual, along with the ninefold process, all these things that we may do, they set the stage. But then the real influx of bhakti is causeless, but is definitely in relationship to the carriers of the bhakti. The bhakti doesn't fully surface unless it is coming through the carriers of the bhakti. So as Giranagi was saying, in one sense it is. As much as who you know is what you know. But they go together. Because who you know, and what you know, and how you know what is there, and use what is there, is also all related to Bhakti Devi knowing one's desires and one's intent. And also being aware of one's previous credits. So all of those things are there. And then, of course, there is most important, the mercy, as we discussed about effort and mercy going together concomitantly. The causes of distress, we look at that. Certain things that bring about the anxiety, the problems, the distress. The cause of distress and the means to, of course, to neutralize. As we understand about some of these negative things that causes mixed devotion to derail or cause us to even lose the shelter of bhakti. We see how the enemy looks, and we can know, how to stump it out, how to avoid it, how to see it within ourselves and how to see it within others, how to help resolve it, how to minimize it growing, and gradually how to even avoid it even coming close. So we listen close as Sri Vishwanath gives these enemies which causes distress. So when we find ourselves feeling distress, he's helping us to know, here are the list of reasons why one has that kind of mentality, why one finds himself in such a situation. Because basically, a real devotee's own main distress is just based on mainly how that one can serve Krishna better. How to serve Krishna better and feeling some sorrow that many people are suffering who are avoiding Krishna. Nothing else the ability is to be distressed about. Nothing else to be distressed about but how we can serve Krishna better. And that entails a lot within itself. And being distressed that others are experiencing. Some people are experiencing some pain. Anything other than that is practically superfluous. And so we will see how Vishwanath elaborates these things. The first distress is caused by five things. Five things that shouldn't be there. Five things that have snuck in. Five things that can become like a cancer if they're not weeded out. First, he explains, is due to neshas. So the lack of knowledge. So ignorance is pervading. So one is experiencing distress. So you think the opposite of these things, it goes out to distress. Proper knowledge and understanding began. Second, he mentions, so one is feeling some problems in their life. One is not happy, sad, remorseful, whatever, different types of maya. And he says, so another thing that causes this, all this stuff chases Bhakti Devi away. Because when Bhakti Devi is there, then there is such firm faith, enthusiasm, determination, etc. So next is ahankara, false ego. So we're feeling some distress, we look to see which is most dominant. Is it the nations? Is it that I am not knowing? I am taking so much mental shelter of the illusions. Because of that, I'm experiencing all these problems and anxieties because of such. I am not allowing my mind, my intelligence, be absorbed in the reflections of transcendence. See where like the Bhakti God is slowly used to say. Where there's Godhead, there's no nation. So where there's light, the darkness goes. Into a dark room, light the candle, put in a flashlight. So now, there's illumination. So this darkness is clouding over the consciousness. And what is perceivable, one is not able to visualize and to experience. So we pull the nations away and we will have no distress. Take away the false ego. So we have genuine divine ego. We are persons. We have idiosyncratic tendencies. We have propensities. And those things are real. Because the soul itself is full of activities, satyatananda, vigra, full of expressions. But when the ego, false ego, that is identifying with what? The ego, intelligence now identifying with the senses and the mind as the king and queens. So now there's a problem. So we accelerate our divine ego, our real identity, as spiritual beings who are having a material experience, but as material beings who are trying to somehow involve ourselves some way in a spiritual experience when we feel it meets our plan. So when we do that, it's mixed, and we'll feel distressful. We're starting from the platform of what I want to do, and then let me see how I can relate it to Krishna in some way. Then ego will trip us up in different ways. But we try to think in terms of what will bring about the greatest spiritual effect. Now let me see how I can position myself in some way to assist, directly or indirectly. This is accelerating the fact that one is a spiritual being who is undergoing a material experience, rather than material entity who somehow fits in the spiritual element. Mishra, mixed bhakti. Everything the Mishras, they bring the pain and they bring distress. So because we really don't want to be distressed, we don't want to go months and months and years, what to say of lifetimes, in anxiety. We all experience anxiety from time to time. We realize it's hellish. To be angry, to be sad, to be depressed, it's very, very hellish. Become like a monster moving about. I am angry. Don't look at me with your eyes. Don't say anything to me. I'm angry. I'm a victim. Don't smile at me. I'm a victim. Cry with me. Cry harder than me. Then I won't feel so victimized. Maybe I'll then see that you are also a victim. We'll have a victim party. A pity party. So it's very intense when we get into those mindsets. We get really stuck in the dark well where it's like no light for us, and we're just bathing in the ignorance of the nation, the false ego. So much of the false ego is all centered around selfishness. So the more that we are just thinking of ourselves, the more we have to deal with, the more we are supporting or putting fire to the fuel, the false ego. And so we'll gradually begin to burn up. Our enthusiasm will burn away. Our appreciation of many things will burn away. And we'll find ourselves feeling so gloomy because so much of our devotional credits is getting burnt up. Here he goes again, number 3. And discusses material attachments. Because all material things are actually temporary, when we who are eternal are too much caught up in temporary stuff, it just doesn't fit. Eternal being who now is so much making the priority the duality, so one will definitely feel miserable, out of place, because it's like being hungry and then just looking at some food in the window or something, looking through somebody else eating. So you feel starved because one is not taking the nourishment. Or being hungry and somebody brings a plate in front of you and it's all artificial fruits and things, and you can't enjoy it. And you're wondering, why am I hungry? What's going on? I feel weak. I feel sad. I'm still hungry, even though this is so beautiful. But it is not the real nourishment. So when people are engaged in so many material things, material attachments, they put so much energy into that, and they're trying to enjoy such, they'll be very distressed. They'll be such, because it doesn't give real stimulation. Next, he explains envy. So it's similar, you can see, that as a devotee is to be selfless, compassionate, feeling the happiness, miseries of others. It's only sad because one is sad with themselves that they're not serving better, and they're sad that somebody else is sad because they care for them. And so this way, you're not envious. Because if somebody, something's happening nice for someone, they're really happy to honor it and encourage it. So what is the question of envy? And because they're not having this ego, they're not thinking, I deserve this, I should have had that, I am better than this person. But when they're having the mindset of self-centeredness, then it will draw the envy. And the, again, ironic thing is while they are putting so much energy into looking and thinking about me, the more they think like that, the more they suffer. The more you have the proper preparation, and the more you keep putting something in it that's improper, then what happens? You don't get a better preparation. So you have the sweet rice, and now you put some salt into it. And so you think, oh, the way to fix it is to put more salt. No. You think, oh, this doesn't taste right. It's a little salt in there. And so then what you do, then you put more salt. You think, well, I'll fix it. That's nice. You put more. So the opposite happens. So Vishwanath Chakravarti is explaining, you know, that these things chases Bhakti Devi away. And such things brings in the Mishra Bhakti, the mixed devotion. So he's trying to help us to understand how the enemy looks, what ways it manifests. And so one can see it in the environment, see within themselves, be able to eliminate it so they will not feel distressed. And if they are not able to eliminate it, then there'll be more and more distress. So we have to look at ourselves from time to time and think, am I actually happy in devotional service? Am I excited? Am I anticipating greater and greater chances to unfold at all different levels because I'm so happy with how already things are going on? As we scientifically honor the process. Or do we look at ourselves and think, I am depressed, I am sad, I am angry, I am envious, I am jealous, I am faithless. And so, as we engage in the bhakti, and these latter things are dominant, then we have to decide, are we going to weed those out as we see the salt in the sweet rice? Or are we going to recognize the difficulty, but then instead of eliminating it, we just add more to the same that's brought the difficulty in the first place? So where we have these pity parties, victimization, where we become more and more faithless, or intensify our false ego, intensify the nations, the false ego, material attachments, then we're stuck. We've seen that in our own lives sometimes. Problem is there, situation, we think, okay, let me take shelter of some stuff, some things that we know is not healthy for devotional service. Some people, when they get a little bewildered in devotional service, they go back and they start smoking again. People, they get bewildered, and they go see some X-rated movie, or they go to prostitution, or take intoxication, something. And so instead of intensifying the consciousness and getting out the salt, intensifying the consciousness, taking more shelter of the things that can eliminate that distress, that Maya influences us to do the things that will add more to the distress. What makes a difference? Difference is Shraddha. Difference is mercy. Difference is Sukriti. Our previous credits determines how the person is responding. So, just like with all these problems that we have sometimes in the institution, Why is it the same problem causes somebody to leave devotional service entirely? Why, same problem, another person, it causes them to become so much more serious about studying the scriptures, about associating, so much more serious about noticing Maya and running away from the Maya, so much more serious and appreciative of honoring Vaishnavas. So, Vishwanath is telling us, no. We have to look a little close and see what's happening with the nations and the false ego and the material attachments and envy. And then he goes on. Let's see, we have talked just five nations, false ego, material attachments, envy. Okay, we have one last one. And that's mundane engrossment or mundane engagements. Sort of similar to attachment, but even more of a lower nature. Attached to all kind of subtle as well as gross things. But here we're talking more about the involvement and absorption in gross stuff. So that should be an obvious one, that we can't cheat Krishna. We can't think that Krishna is so dull or insensitive, so much a conception, not real supreme personality, that we can be thinking and be connecting and doing all kind of crazy stuff. I think Krishna is going to, Bhakti Devi is going to honor and bless us and reciprocate. That we are calling all kind of other things, we're doing all kind of other things, we're summoning the Maya, and that Bhakti Devi is going to come while we're calling all this Maya. He doesn't want to come to a place where the environment is the associates of Maya. Just like a very royal person, there's no desire to come into such a degraded environment. A person who's very clean, you know, very ecumenical, they're totally uncomfortable in a situation where people are just talking about useless things, where people are engaging in gross, sinful things, where people are abusing things. You know, they feel totally out of station. No interest. Want to run away from such things. Even the entities from higher planets, they don't want to come to an environment where there's all this mode of ignorance and little mode of passion, mostly ignorance. Why? No. Like or draw likes. Bhakti draws bhakti. So similarly, where we are trying to pursue devotional lifestyle, we are going through the motions, but at the same time, we got all this other stuff going on. It's going to chase out, or it's going to send a signal to Bhakti Devi that we don't really want her. And so the sad thing, that not only have we chased away the bhakti, but we bring in more and more nations, which means, of this Grossman, as he explained, which means now more pain, more distress, more sadness. Like I was mentioning to some of the devotees in South Africa, and I was saying how it's quite painful that I went on the tour, you know, to France and to Switzerland and Sweden and Austria and Italy and so many places, to see the number of Vaishnavas and were miserable. Now, why? Prabhupada didn't cheat us. These great devotees, they're not lying. So it means that we're cheating. Because Vishwanath Chakravarti, he says, what things causes the distress? And it wasn't that devotees were distressed because they were really experiencing the process, really unfolding, happy, and just sad that some people weren't experiencing what they're experiencing. Or sad that more people in mature energy are not taking advantage. But their sadness was all about me and I. My this and my that.
But also, obviously that was there because also some things about the environment. But then we think, Prabhupada did not create a society for us to come together to mutually suffer while we think about transcendence. Nobody wants to be suffering themselves or be surrounded by such when there is no reason. Someone has wealth, then they're so filthy. And rather medical type person, no desire to be around such. There's no reason for it. Even when one is poor, there's a difference between poverty and just triflingness. Somebody can be trifling because they're poor. They can decide, okay, I'm poor, and I'm defeated, and I'm useless, and therefore everything I do is in that mood. You see, so many places and villages, people are simple, and they're poor, but they're clean, and they have some spunk about life, because what they do have, they actually value it. They take care of it. And those people in little villages are so clean. They sweep their little clay areas every day. Get up early in the morning. I've seen this place in Africa, Latin America. People live in little villages, and they rise. Before the sun rises, they're rising, and they're cleaning everything in their little compounds. And take bath every day. Sometimes several times a day. There are many, many people in society today who do not take a bath every day. Majority of people on this planet, they don't bathe every day. We may think that it's just natural to bathe every day. Most people do not bathe every day. You just stand in a car meet rest stop for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And you see that most people who come in here do not even wash their hands after using the door. I don't know about the women, but in the men's, people come out of the bathroom constantly. They don't even wash their hands. That only takes a second. What does they have bathing? People don't bathe. Those times when there's so much royalty, the aristocratic class, they didn't bathe. It's one of the reasons why Prince Perfume, it's so powerful. That perfume came out of the fact that people were so funky, through the expression, dressing very, very, very vulgarly. But at the same time, they were not bathing. They are huge castles. They have all these big rooms, so much splendor. And there are no bathrooms. And you know, they didn't have bathrooms in those days, the aristocratic class. These huge castles, they would sometimes just go to a room and just pass, or they'd have buckets and they'd just pass. They were so much sophisticated animals. And there were times in our history where we see that the rich Greek and Romans, they would just eat. And then they would stuff themselves with so much, then they have these silver and golden pans, then they vomit up so they can keep on eating more. So what's it called? An bulimia and anorexia? It's nothing new. But they use it in a different way. Because they weren't concerned about their weight. They just wanted to enjoy more. And so they eat so much, and then you were full. But then the sensation is, I want more, I want more. So they throw up, they can eat some more. So, what we're living, or trying to live, it is something quite different. I remember when I was in school as a kid, we should talk about the Saturday night bath. We would bathe once a week on Saturdays. And some of the kids, they didn't like that. Oh, I gotta stop playing. It's time for the Saturday night bath. They said he had to go in a little earlier and take a bath. Most people I knew in my neighborhood, we bathed. Well, you throw some water on your face, do a little washcloth, but you bathe once a week. That wasn't so long ago. I'm not that old. It was like ancient times. So, and I saw in college, I couldn't believe it. Huh? In college, so many people, friends, associates. And there we were at an Ivy League school. People supposedly have refined intelligence. People supposedly are going to go out and change the world. I never seen people so degraded. And the prep school I went to, super rich people, never seen people so degraded. It's like reading something out of a horror book that people would do sometimes. You're trying to hear, you think about Krishna, you want to be absorbed as a sadhu, and then there's somebody who gets all this pajapa stuff. You feel extremely uncomfortable because it does not fit in your grain. But if in your own consciousness there's so much envy, nescience, so much falsity, all these other things, then not only do you feel comfortable with such, but you look for people who you can share and they can share that kind of stuff with you. That's why you notice many times when devotees bloop, they often find association with other bloop devotees so they can somehow rationalize the fact that they follow one principle. Because they know Krishna, so they can't get that out of their consciousness fully. But at the same time, they're not ready to be freed of any of this Mishra Bhakti. And so the tendency then is to seek out environments that can help to reinforce their nescience so that you don't have to deal with the illumination, eradicating the nescience, or having to deal with the fact of how much steep they are in the nescience. So Maya has all these different tricks to reinforce the illusion. So these five things we look at as the causes of distress. So we eliminate those so that we are not experiencing distress. No devotee should be experiencing distress other than that is due from compassion. And where there is, then we have to do our homework more seriously. We have to be more genuine about what the process is, and we have to be more conscious about following it. So then Vishwanath Chakravarti court talks on again about the means to neutralize them and these causes. And as he's talking about these kleshas, this is the category of the stresses, he gives us four stages how sinful reactions are part of the distress. And so he gives us these four categories. So we just remind you, you've all heard these in the past or in different times. First, he talks about what is called prarabdha, already mature sins that we've gotten reaction from. They've already fructified, produces certain types of results in our life. They've already put certain types of problems before us that we had to deal with. So this is the first category of the sinful reactions. The second is just aparabdha. Those sins that we have done, but they haven't matured yet. They haven't caught up with us yet. They haven't begun to beat us yet. They're in the background, and they're waiting, they're in line, waiting for their chance to attack us, to chastise us. And so those are there. Some we've already done, we're going through, or already have gone through, and then some that are near but around the corner. Then there is the what's called the kuta, which is the stage before the seed. And you can understand what the next one is the bijam, or the seed stage. So we understand that we have the sinful activities, which must be stopped. We must also weed out the seeds. Because sometimes we stop the sinful activities, but still, so much of the seed is there for the sinful thing. And because it's planted, just certain types of nourishment will cause it to sprout. And then it'll turn into sinful action, sinful thoughts, sinful speech. Farming has some idea. Hopefully they'll start having some better ideas. So they have some ideas, and so they plow up the ground, and then now they must go considering, based on the idea, what they're going to plant. And so this bijam is like before the actual seed is planted. You have to do certain things that now arranges for us to plant the seed. And once the seed is there, then you give water to it, weed it, then later you harvest. So it's like the harvest is those things you've already have planted, it's matured, and you've used it, and now you've eaten it, etc. And those not at the mature stage, it's like what's been planted, still in the ground, but hasn't been taken out yet, because it's not quite ripe. But it's there, and you're realizing, okay, it's there and you're watching. At some point, you can take it out. And so all of these are analogous to the stages of the sin. And we have to check all of it. We have to stop the plan for the sin, or making the arena for it. Like when Lord Chaitanya cleaned the Gandhija temple. After he did the growth, he did the subtle, and then he cleaned outside. It shows that he was now not only stopping the looking at the gross and the subtle, but also making arrangements so much of the stuff could not come back in. So there would not be the plan to summon the other stuff. So we deal with the seed, and then the mentality plans that produces the seed, that produces the nourishment, that produces the weed, and then the weed chokes. See, it's much more difficult once it has been planted and been nourished. Then you start trying to get it out, it's a problem. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of work once we situate our consciousness and our senses in Maya. Then we try to stop something. It becomes very difficult. Because now it's become a part of our consciousness. We've seen sometimes. You deviate, you get in a slump, you fall down. It's not just that only that fall, but it's now how that fall and those things are now permeating throughout your existence. It has a reverberating effect. And so it takes a lot of time and more credits and adjustments to try to pick oneself back up. And many times, when a person falls like that, sometimes they never get back up again properly, because it's vibrating so much throughout the consciousness, the effects. And that's why so much better to avoid, so much better to not even let the seed get in there. But the seed is there. Take it up. A lot easier to take it up then than when the plant is growing. And what happened when the weed and the plant starts growing? It is growing, you got to pull up from the root, but also sometimes it is growing, it's shedding more other seeds, and so you pull that weed up, and then later you got so many other weeds that are also there that have come up due to that one weed. As we make these anarthas, offenses, aparats, as we engage in these Mishra things, the enviousness, neshams, gross attachments, etc., then the things we do are bad enough in themselves. But even worse is the effects of those things. That one weed, bad, can give a problem. But worse is that weed is going now to bring others. It's like we've seen some unmentionables. Some roaches. So when you see a roach, it's not just that one roach is there. It means there's others. They're around. You see a mice, you see a rat. So what you are seeing, yes, is there. But that same mice, the same rat, it's going to make so many others. And so as it's around, after a while, you're going to have a rat-infested house. On its surface. And you just let it go on and go on. Before you know it, you come in the house, they'll start jumping at you, jumping all around, jumping out of the cabin, jumping out of the drawer, jumping here, there. And you wonder how. How did that happen? Well, it was organic. You had one there. But how did it get in? So you had some food, you had some garbage you wasn't taking out. Because you weren't taking the garbage out, you were studying an environment, inviting them.
Right? You study an environment that's calling, that's summoning them. And so if you avoid studying the environment, then you won't have to deal with some, with them coming, and have to deal with the one you saw and then the many others that are there. So if somehow we do not have more of a alert consciousness, then what happens is we bring so much stuff into our environment, into our consciousness, into our life, then we have all this distress trying to deal with eliminating it. When certain simple things could have checked it in the first place. This is the idea that devotional service is really simple, but it's rather complicated when we're not honest, complicated when we're lazy, complicated when we take Maya for granted. And this is why the devotees of the Lord have this great compassion, because they constantly see how living entities are entangling themselves when they really can rise above it, when they really can make a different choice, another choice. Or when they see how a person has engaged in this sinful activity and they are setting the stage for some other negative reaction because there is those sins that are not mature that are around the corner that can come upon one. So, you see, my Bhagavatam, we have those four categories. Prarabdha, aprarabdha. First is matured, next is not matured, then the seed, or the environment that brings the seed. The scriptures also confirm that the Lord's devotees are automatically embellished with all the excellent qualities that are found in the demigods. Let me read that better so you know what it's referring to. Sins are abominable, and they add only partially to man's mature distress. The good traits in man are his aversions toward the temporary attraction for the divine that is connected to the supreme. Acceptance of that which is favorable to devotional service. So, you know, here's Sri Vishwanath talking about counteracting that. So accepting things that are favorable, and he gives an example. Service, mercy, forgiveness, truthfulness, simplicity, impartiality, patience, gravity, respectfulness, humility, good. These are all good fortune. These are all things that eliminate the seeds in any way. The weeds, the seeds, or the environment for the seeds. We won't go into those, explaining those. They're kind of self-explanatory, actually. Just mention it one more time. Devotional service, mercy, forgiveness, truthfulness, simplicity, impartiality, patience, gravity, respectfulness, humility. See, these are all things of compassion and selflessness. Things that it's not about aham ameti, me and my body and my desires, but about the service of the Lord. So, these last things, we want to look even a little closer, a little more subtle, but very important as we unfold in our devotional service. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.2.42 declares, Bhakti Praneshanu Bhavo Vikrati Ranyatra Chaisa Trika Ihakala, that along with devotional surrender and direct perception of the Supreme Lord, aversion to and detachment from matter occur simultaneously. Aversion, running away, and attachment. This supports the principle discussed earlier that sadhana bhakti destroys distress and bestows good fortune. These version to and detachment from. Okay, let's tune into this. Now, although both these leaves of sadhana bhakti sprout at the same time, there's still a slight difference in their growth. That is the lapse between distress being destroyed and good fortune being bestowed. Remember, devotional service does these two things, bhakti devi. Eradicates the distress, that's one thing, one on one hand. The other side brings a great fortune. So there's sometimes a lapse between these. And sometimes there can be a problem, although it's close, but sometimes we are being freed of some of the problems, but we have not developed a higher taste yet.
And sometimes there's an interval period before we are developing a higher taste. With proper perseverance, it comes. But sometimes, while we're doing in that transitional period, where we stop some of the negative things, and we're so much, especially these days, we're so much in a kind of a, the fast lane, you know, such a take society. Everything's, you know, fast food, fastest, tomorrow. So the tendency is constantly looking for very, very quick reciprocation on our own time scheme. So because of that, what happens sometimes is that our faith is not so strong. As we stop something, we don't get the immediate reciprocation that we want or what we think we should be having. So then we can lose faith and then go back or think that it doesn't work, etc. So faith is very important, especially when we're undergoing the transition or we are going from one chapter to the next, one level to the next. And the faith is supported, of course, by healthy association. Bhakti begins with faith. Shraddha. The pilgrim undertakes a journey on the path of devotion, must have faith, Shraddha. But again, it can't be blind faith, it has to be real faith. And real faith is based on good experiences happening to one and good concerns about the future. Faith is synonymous with firm conviction to act on the words and the instructions of devotional scriptures. And now he explains that even faith is of two kinds. He calls it one case swabhaviki, that is natural, and balopatika, inspired by external. So that is natural. Again, that has a lot to do with what you bring into from previous lives. And so there's some storage you have. And so that will ignite with whatever is happening in the immediate environment. So the faith, something that's natural, that is an integral part of your inner core being, and then things that are external that come together produces a certain quality of faith. We know good association, as we were reading, discussing yesterday, how the bhakti is mainly found in the heart of the bhakta, the unalloyed bhakta. So that's an external coming in contact. It makes a difference. Now, sincerely following the spiritual master's instructions bestows upon the disciple the good fortune of wanting to associate with devotees and to engage in the process of devotional service. And this, of course, which we'll end our discussion on today, is the bhajana kriya. So bhajana kriya is now the activities where one now has begun to involve themselves in this process that ultimately leads to ruchi and to prema. Bhajana kriya is divided into two parts. So these two parts, and we won't give you too much because there'll be an overload, so we'll stop with, as we categorize this bhajana kriya, reflect on that, and tomorrow we'll go into other areas. And each day we'll address certain things like this. So the two areas of bhajana kriya is anishthita, and just understand the English basically, the unsteady, and then the nishita, which of course is steady. So when devotional activities are performed on the nishita or nishita platform, there's no fear. That means when it's steady platform, there's no fear, there's no duality, degradation, etc. Unsteady devotional service, this is where the problem is. So the last category we want to look at is the unsteady areas as we engage in bhajan kriya. How they look, how they surface. This is, we got the neshans thing. The five causes of distress. Neshans, envy, pride, etc. Now we look at the six categories of unsteady platform here. So first, it's called utsahaya mayi. Now in English that just means sudden enthusiasm. And this we can kind of tune into. Sometimes when a person first joins or comes in contact with the process, they have this burst of zeal and enthusiasm. And sometimes it's based on a lot of pride. They're kind of thinking, oh, I'm so special. Or they're thinking that overnight they're going to get the full result. So they have sort of a raw enthusiasm. It's there, but it's quite raw, immature. It's very shallow. So that can be a problem, because that's the one in how now has to really pay their dues. They may not have the perseverance or determination. The other is called, second, is called Gana Karala. Sometimes enthusiastic, sometimes lethargic. So, in neophyte stages, where these problems are there, there's the tendency, kind of the Bogo Tiaga sort of mood, where, you know, we get excited about this, about that, because we're all still so much doing, we're still doing so much things based on our own sensations and feelings. And then something else, and we're not enthusiastic, we become, you know, lethargic, apathetic. So that's going back and forth. So these are signs of unsteadiness that is adding to the, you know, to the Mishra Bhakti, the mixed devotion, rather than, you know, the path from a Sudha Bhakti. So next three, it's called Vyudha Vikalpa. Now this is the stage when doubt assails one's resolve. This stage, you kind of explain this a little bit. Stage like you're thinking, well, Scripture says, "Also, life is a dark well," and so therefore, maybe I should marry, maybe I shouldn't marry. Let's see. The stage where we are thinking, we're jumping the gun. No. Okay, so it's a stage where we are vacillating back and forth. Maybe I should join temple, but if I join, what are my friends going to think? And if I join, how am I still going to be able to go, you know, to the disco from time to time? Maybe I shouldn't join. Perhaps I should consider going to this part of the world, and I can serve and I can study there. But if I do that, then I don't know. Then I'm going to be away from my mother and my uncle and cousin, niece, nephew. So I don't think so. So some desire is there for some acceleration in devotion. But at the same time, there's so much other stuff that's coming up that one's consciousness goes to. There are many, many different things that it can be distracting in that way. So that's the stage when doubts assail. So some determination is there. But all these other flicking things, the doubts are actually stronger. So the person doesn't really act on the devotion. And so the next is number four, and there's only two more, and then we'll stop. It's called Visaya Sangara. This is a stage of internal tug of war with material sense enjoyment. Now let's kind of look at what the difference between what I just said earlier. Visaya Saga is a stage when conflicting doubts and arguments are resolved in the devotee's heart, and he's convinced about the path of renunciation. See, in the third stage, the doubts and the vacillating is there, but the doubt is actually stronger. In this next stage, there's also flickering back and forth, but the understanding is stronger. But one is not having the strength to act upon the understanding. We may see that in different points and times in our own life, where there was a point where we had just more doubts than understanding in the devotional service. So we're going back and forth, but we're mostly captured by doubt. And then a point where we have more faith and belief about what is to be done, but our determination isn't strong enough, our senses are pulling us so much, even though we know what is supposed to be done, we don't actually do it. So Sri Vishnanath explains it. He says, in this stage, when conflicting doubts and arguments are resolved in the devotee's heart, he is convinced about the path of renunciation. Scripture states that just as an object lost in the West cannot be found in the East, similarly a person engrossed in mature activities will never become attached to Krishna. The devotee feels that his desires for sensual enjoyment are forcing him toward fulfilling them. So he knows what is to be done, but he's feeling too forced. He's acting upon things in spite of his knowledge. Therefore, he thinks he should immediately discard those desires and wholeheartedly chant the holy name. Although even in the process, he may sometimes fall victim to sense gratification. The devotee still remains convinced of the spiritual truth that perfection can be achieved. Now, many times, this one we're very common with, in that we know what is proper, but our senses and mind pull us. And even though we may deviate or we may get bewildered, we may fall into a slump, but still, our intelligence is fixed that we have to get out of this and we have to keep moving toward the goal. And we keep picking ourselves up in such a way. So this is a level of conscious unfoldment. The fifth stage, unsteady devotional service, is called Niyama Sama, where the devotee vows to increase his devotional activities. He resolves to chant so many rounds daily, offer prostrated obeisances. Daily he makes these vows, but at the last moment he is unable to honor them. The difference between these two, in the former the devotee is helpless to give up material sense pleasures, and the latter he is unable to increase and improve his devotional activities. So in this case, Where previously the sinful things were stronger, or the doubts were stronger, the sinful things, and the intelligence was there. Now in this category, the issue is that one basically not having enough healthy and good association. Or one is unable to increase and improve his devotional activities. So one knows that a standard is not proper. One also has the intelligence. But somehow they're still able to improve their standard. Also, it has to do with their desires also, because Krishna will give the strength, the desire strong enough. But also, the desires get stronger by the proper healthy association and honoring that healthy association. So here, in all these different categories, where one is just having the shallow enthusiasm, first category, and a little bit of puffed up of pride. Second, where enthusiasm is there, but it comes and it goes, you know, the Bhagavatyanga, you know, and the up and down, highs and lows, like anything. Then the third category is one has many, many doubts, and the doubts are stronger than their faith and belief. And then the fourth category is that there's this tug of war, and in the tug of war, the sinful things are stronger, although the intelligence knows better. And in the fifth category, the intelligence is very fixed, and the sinful things are no longer more dominant, but the higher thing does not unfold yet in the one's realization and consciousness and experience. And that can have a lot to do with the desires not being strong enough, where it brings in the higher tastes and higher experiences, etc. So even this is a dangerous period, because one can lose determination, or one can sort of start backtracking, start rationalizing so many other things, because we are pleasure seekers, and if one is unable to improve their devotional character, then they can start thinking that it's impossible, that it's too difficult. They can start thinking that that maybe their desires for trying to get the thing is improper, so they should settle into something lower. Now here's the last one, and we'll end with this. The last category is called Taranga Ragini. This last stage of the Anishta, devotional service, describes the nature of bhakti. It said that everyone is attracted toward the reservoir of bhakti. So now in this last stage, the devotee himself becomes a treasure house of good qualities and mercy. That means the devotee has now went through all of this stuff, he's passed through all of it, and he or she have become somewhat strong, somewhat secure. But now what happens, that this devotee started getting adoration, distinction, fame, so many different things. And so now, even though the devotee's gotten that far, there's this last danger. The danger that the person may start trying to accept it, to own up to it, and feel that it is all coming from them. And then they can start going down again. That's the worst. Or they stay stagnant at that particular level. So Vishwanath includes by saying, these characteristics attract people. So when the devotee has now moved to the others, he or she will become effulgent, and they'll have some vibrancy. And so they will attract people. People will become encouraged, influenced, attracted. So these will attract people who in turn will crown the devotee with wealth, will give devotee adoration, distinction, and position. Although these accolades come to him by byproducts of bhakti, they nevertheless may stunt the spontaneous growth of the creeper of the devotee, unless if he uses them for his self-aggrandizement. And we see time and time again that how many of our own devotees in big positions, that this is the one that really kills them. That they have, we all go to the points of, you know, the initial stimulation, excitement. Then we have to start doing working on ourselves. You start working on ourselves. We have all these doubts that come up. Then gradually we're able to conquer over the doubts. And then we have still so much action that's pulling us one way or another. And then we get over those sinful things. And then later, we are somehow knowing what is right, but not feeling the higher taste, but not being able to change our character. And sometimes we go even to the point of being able to change our position, gross as well as subtle. And now, we're getting respect for the level that we have acquired or achieved, for the things that we're doing. And now, Bhakti Dev is really watching to see how much he's really going to come forth in our life. And so at that point, where one is getting the adoration and getting various types of gifts or facilities, then Bhakti Devi is like watching the Maya to see, okay, now what is the person really going to keep as their priority? And so sometimes they get stuck there at that level. If not careful, you get stuck too long at any level, you start regressing. So we'll stop at this today, but we are mainly looking at bhakti unfolding, the position of the faith, why faith gets one person to accept one thing versus another. And even after they've accepted, then how things begin to unfold based on this and offset, based on consciousness, etc. And as we perceive and know how some of these stagnations look, then we have better idea to run away from them, or better idea how to get them out of our system. It's just extreme mercy how these great Nitya Siddhas, they give us all of these things as a way to make the path clear for us to rise above whatever the molds and how they unfold. But if we don't honor them sufficiently, we don't study what they've given us, we don't reflect on it, we don't use it in our lives, then even though we have such powerful things, we will get bombarded by so many obfuscations and then wonder why we're getting more and more distressed. And so Vishwanath Chakravarti is really trying to help us to be free of our distress in this particular section. Any questions or comments? Nobody should go around feeling distressed. If you're distressed, then do the inventory to find out what are the factors that's responsible for it and work on eliminating those things. Yes,
Gurudev, in the state then, when you're not necessarily getting the higher taste, but you're kind of refraining from activities and then there's still some improper desire, then would the key to overcoming that be like being totally steady in our service?
Yes, steady in the service with the proper service consciousness of humility. Because one can be steady in the service while they're obnoxiously knocking everybody else around and abusing everyone else and being condescending. And they say, well, I'm steady. I mean, I'm here every day. Every day, every day I do the boga run. Or every day I clean the floor. In the process of cleaning the floor, you're shouting on people, you're hitting people with the mop in the room. You say, but look at me, I'm doing my service every day. Get out of here. So, not just the action. Any other questions?
Thank you, Maharaj. It's such a nice presentation. I can say it's so scrutinizingly helping us to analyze where we're at in Krishna consciousness, and I was wondering, how can we develop the courage to be so personally scrutinizing with ourselves now that we've heard you know, so much. You can kind of, you know, you can see different where, you know, places where your weaknesses are now. But how can you really, you know, drum up that courage to, like, decide to grab the bull by the horn, so to speak, and say, okay, let me, I got to move from here. I can't stay here.
It's not so much, we need to have so much courage. But we need to have so much distaste for the pain. We have enough distaste for the distress and pain, we realize I got to do something. I'm going to keep myself wallowing in this pain. I'm going to keep my life in such anxiety. Life is not just to be in such anxiety. So we kind of have to love ourselves a little more. Pain, enough pain is enough. Enough is enough. Got to stop it. Got to stop torturing myself. Exactly. Got to stop torturing myself. Any other questions?
Yeah. Somehow these thoughts just came from the answer you gave, Drupal Mavati. But I was wondering, how much does karmic conditioning have to do with carrying on with these stagnations? And I guess the thought just came to me as I was looking at Srila Prabhupada, that he was the embodiment of mercy. He is the embodiment of, as you talked about the story last night, of extending the rope. He was that embodiment, extending the rope. He's that embodiment of being a pure devotee. He's that embodiment of so many wonderful things to connect one with bhakti, but yet all the members of his family didn't take to bhakti. So
right, most of them, exactly. Even most of his children. Even one of his sons, really the opposite. He tried to take away bhakti. He had to go to court after Prabhupada left the planet. One of his sons was trying to take over the whole institution. He claimed that Prabhupada was a businessman, and so the ISKCON Society is the business. And so as he is the son, then he should get all the assets of everything. So we, you know, we're being threatened to have everything that was done in Prabhupada's service taken away by one of his sons who was going to take it as a business, like that. So, to go to, actually, Narayan Maharaj is very instrumental in helping just to save the society from these getting taken away. He went to court and other devotees and spoke very strong on these issues. So, yes, it shows two things it shows. First, it shows the power of free will. That, I mean, just like in the case of Pallad, I mean, Hiranyakasipu, you know, he was a demon, and at the same time, Pallad was a pure devotee. Or, who was it, Advaitacharya, who had the two sons who impersonated? Advaitacharya? I mean, you know, he's the Mahavishnu, and he got sons who impersonated. Or ourselves, we're all part and parcel of Krishna, and there's all kind of ways we're expressing our free will. So, yes, free will is there, and it can be used in different ways. Or as we mentioned about Lord Chaitanya with, you know, Kala Krishna, and how with Krishna and himself, his only servant in this case, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the most magnanimous expression of Krishna. And still, free will was there, and he deviated. But we also see karma factor. We don't just take karma only as, okay, just the karma and that's it. But just as Vishwanath is explaining, there's so many levels of that we look at karma. Things that are mature, things that are about to mature, seeds, the environment that brings the seeds. So all of this is part of the person's package that makes up who they are. And it just determines what they're carrying. So somebody may be bringing to the situation a little less, and so it's going to be harder for them. No question about it, but not impossible. Just like, you know, say, you know, our children. So now, according to how they get trained up academically, some of them go, you know, to the university later. So if their training is good, then they're going to do good. If their training is very good, they're going to do even better than the average children. But if their training is not so good, then they go to these schools and have a big problem. Doesn't mean they can't be successful, but it means they're bringing something in initially. So in some cases, we have, you know, we see people bring in very little, and it's so overwhelming that they just drop out. So in some cases, we have devotees who come into devotional service, and they brought so little from previous lifetimes, that it just seemed insurmountable to them, trying to deal with the, you know, the challenges. And in some cases, there's some devotees who, although there's all kind of stuff happening all around them, they seem almost naive. But it's not that they're naive, it's just that they're so fixed. Sometimes some devotees are just so fixed that whatever's happened, it doesn't slow them down, they just keep moving. And it often has a lot to do with the kind of credit they have acquired from previous life, as well as how they're processing things in this lifetime. So we should never feel that, well, what can I do? This is me. I mean, is this my karma? Yeah, some karma is definitely there. As we were discussing yesterday, Krishna's mercy is causeless. And so that mercy is available for everyone. But distinctly, we do know that we do bring something to the table. And that's why we also must have sufficient mercy, because we don't always know what people have brought to the table. What kind of stuff they've been through in previous lifetimes, etc. And good or bad. But whatever they bring to the table, if the table itself is very powerful, then whatever they have or didn't have, still they're going to now be able to have great sense of productivity. But if when they bring something to the table, and table itself, the environment is not so strong, then there's a big problem. Any last question? So reflect on these things. We'll stop there because if you give too much in one day, it's kind of an overload. But each day we'll focus in on a different area. If we look a little closer at bhakti, how it's entering into our lives, how it's in the community, how it's being made available for us by Srila Prabhupada and the great acharyas. Especially during this Kartik, we take greater introspection, try to catch up for deeper level of bhakti, deeper connection. ISKCON found the chart, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Tira Prabhupada Ki, C.C. Radha Dhamma Dara Radha Kala Chandi Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Gaur Nithai Ki.